It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, one programming note here. Join us tomorrow afternoon at 1 for the annual State of the Tribes address streaming online at WPR.org. Forest County Potawatomi Chairman Ned Daniels presents the address before a joint session of the legislature, and you can catch a rebroadcast of the State of the Tribes address tomorrow evening at 7 right here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're exploring the latest in state politics, starting with the spring primary for Wisconsin's Supreme Court that is set for tomorrow. Also noteworthy here, voters in the 7th Congressional District will have a congressional primary tomorrow as well. That's a seat that was vacated by former Congressman Sean Duffy. Are you a registered voter, or do you plan to register at the polls tomorrow? How are you going to vote in tomorrow's Supreme Court primary? What do you like about the candidates? What have they been saying in their campaigns that interests you? 800-642-1234. Patrick Marley covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've been covering the state Supreme Court primary election. How have you heard these three candidates trying to distinguish themselves to the voters?
Well, Justice Daniel Kelly is part of the conservative majority on the court. He was appointed in 2016 and is now seeking a full 10-year term. He's positioned himself like a lot of conservatives have in the past in the mold of Antonin Scalia or other textualists, saying that he interprets the law as written, very much stresses that he's not going to put his own ideas into his opinions. His opponents have won backing from liberals. That's Ed Falone and Joe Karofsky. Karofsky is a judge in the Dane County Circuit Court, and Falone is a longtime law professor at Marquette University. They say that Kelly is not what he appears, that he has an agenda, and that they would be more independent-minded. Karofsky really talked a lot about her values, stressed those, which are often along the sort of progressive viewpoints. Has been maybe less shy than other candidates about stating her personal opinions, such as, you know, her opposition to Donald Trump, for instance.
She did not vote for him in 2016 and wouldn't vote for him in the future?
That's correct. Whereas the other candidates won't say what, and as is typical with judicial candidates, won't say how they would vote in partisan elections. Dan Kelly did get an endorsement from Donald Trump. He was in Milwaukee in January, and he gave a brief shout out to Kelly from the stage. Falone has said that he thinks one problem with Supreme Court elections in the past is that candidates like Kelly have sort of put forth this overarching judicial philosophy that they say they adhere to. He says there's no sort of one-size-fits-all philosophy, that each case has to be approached independently and specific to those facts rather than trying to shoehorn it into a specific way of looking at the law.
Justice Dan Kelly fell under public scrutiny when Governor Walker appointed him to the bench in 2016. His appointment drew controversy because of his writings on same-sex marriage and affirmative action. Have we learned new information about Justice Kelly from his first election, his actions on the bench?
Before he was on the court, he maintained a blog with some other conservatives. And so that did draw attention at the time and hasn't been selected because of his opposition to same-sex marriage, his statement that abortion, people who support abortion do so, or organizations that support abortion, so to protect sexual routinism, and that they know that they're harming children. So those statements have drawn attention, have drawn some criticism. He has since taken those blogs down and said that at that time it was okay for him to state his views because he wasn't a judge or a judicial candidate. Now that he is, he tries to separate himself from his personal views and doesn't talk about them.
Is Justice Kelly running a campaign similar to Justice Brian Hagedorn, part of the court's, you know, conservative wing, who voters elected last year?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question there.
Yeah, is Justice Kelly running a similar campaign to the campaign that Justice Brian Hagedorn ran last year?
Oh, I mean, I think his campaign is similar. Sure, there's similarities with the Haggerty campaign. There's similarities with the way lots of conservatives have run in the past. Conservatives have had a very successful decade on the Supreme Court. I mean, there have been some races that they lost, notably the one that Rebecca Dowlett won a couple of years ago. But conservatives had a very effective strategy in getting their supporters to the polls. And so, you know, as when liberals or Democrats have successes, they repeat those strategies. The conservatives are doing the same thing here.
We're catching up on state politics with Patrick Marley, who covers the Capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in. What questions do you have about the court battle over whether to remove more than 200,000 names from voter registration databases? How do you think this should be resolved? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sticking with the primary election tomorrow, let's go to Mark now, joining us from Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I'm become a supporter for Jill Karofsky. She appeared before our group of I've been getting involved with these Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in Appleton, and she came and gave us a brief talk, and very impressive. And I just wanted to echo my support for her.
When you say very impressive, Mark, what stood out?
Need ask me that. I just felt like she had some progressive ideals and that she had, you know, common sense solutions. I guess I can't pin down anything too specific, but yeah.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for the call. Patrick, do you find Jill Karofsky's first time running for the Supreme Court? She has talked about trying to follow the path of Justice Rebecca Dowlett, part of the court's liberal wing. Do you see similarities there in their campaigns and what they represent?
Yes, you asked before if Kelly was using the model of Hagedorn, and of course, conservatives are trying. He is trying to replicate that campaign because Hagedorn had a come from behind victory in that race. Similarly, Karofsky is trying to follow the model of Rebecca Dowlett, because she's one of the few liberals who was able to win. She won an open seat a couple of years ago after a long string of conservatives winning such races. And so, yeah, I think Karofsky is trying to follow a similar path. Fallon maybe is a little different model. Ed Fallon ran in 2013 and lost to Patience Rubensack. I think he's trying to build on the support that he did find in that race. So maybe a little bit of a different model, but I do think there are parallels between what Karofsky is trying to do and what Rebecca Dowlett did do.
Justice Kelly has led the field in fundraising. How much of an advantage from campaign cash does that give a candidate?
Yeah, it's really big. He's raised, almost $1 million. Not quite that much, but he got an earlier head start because he was on the court and knew that he was running again. Karofsky's raised, I think, less than half than that, and Ed Sloan considerably less than that. So there is a big fundraising edge here, and that will likely persist whoever gets through the primary. However, probably the liberal will be able to consolidate some support. Their outside spending would probably begin after the primary. So I think you'll start to see things even out money-wise, but it does look like Kelly's going to be able to maintain a pretty big edge in fundraising.
So if one candidate ends up winning a big portion of the vote tomorrow, how much does that forecast their chances in April?
I think it's hard to draw too many conclusions because you're going to have a much bigger turnout in April than you do in February. You always have a higher turnout at the general election. And then, of course, this year, the April 7 primary is, or April 7 general election for Supreme Court is the same day as the primary in the presidential race. And so you'll see a lot more voters coming out. So, you could have someone who places first in the primary could come in second in the general. So I don't think you can read too much in terms of the vote share in tomorrow's primary to the general election.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with Sargi in Lake Haley.
Lake Haley, yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I've always wondered this. If we're supposed to be a representative democracy, why are we stopping people from voting? Why is voting not a mandatory thing, even if you just vote, I don't want to vote?
Sargi, thanks for the call. Patrick, you know, what can you say about the representative democracy statement there?
Yeah, so I don't know. You know, I haven't heard that idea of making voting mandatory. Certainly there are things that could be done to encourage more people to vote. You know, we have the system that elected officials have put in place. They've set the voting rules. You know, I think it's up for policymakers. It's not up for me to decide what the rules should be. I'm just a reporter. I just tell you what they are.
Well, one issue being appealed in the courts right now is whether the more than 200,000 names should be removed from voter registration lists. You recently analyzed the voting records. What did you learn?
So, yeah, there's 232,000 people who got letters in the fall from the state saying they believe that they had moved and should either update their voter registrations or confirm if they hadn't moved that they're still at the same address. The state planned to take those people off the rolls in 2021, but then a lawsuit came along saying they should get off the rolls much faster. So far, that lawsuit has not been successful. No one's been taken off the rolls, but, you know, the appeals court is considering it now. Could eventually get to the Supreme Court, so that could change. What we found when we looked at who got the letters, it's a very reliable set of voters. 72% of them voted in 2016's presidential election. I think, almost a third of them had voted in all three of the last presidential elections. 78% of them voted in at least one of those three.
Well, let's pause right there with those numbers. We have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state politics reporter Patrick Marley with us as our guide as we look at the latest in state politics. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State Capitol reporter Patrick Marley as our guide on this installment of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's look now at competing legislation over sexual assault evidence. The Assembly passed a Republican version of a bill to prevent a future backlog of sexual assault kits last week, but that drew sharp criticism from Democrats for including provisions related to immigration and school vouchers. What do you think of the GOP proposal that is headed to the Senate? Are you a police officer, an attorney, a nurse, someone else who works with survivors of sexual assault? What do you think is needed to improve how Wisconsin handles sexual assault cases and evidence? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. And Patrick Marley stays with us. So, Patrick, another battle in the Capitol this month involves the legislative proposals to change how the state manages evidence from sexual assault cases. There is now competing legislation in the chambers. What is at the heart of this dispute?
So the bulk of these bills do the same thing. The Senate passed it in the fall on a voice vote, really no opposition to it. The Assembly passed it on partisan lines here the other day. This is to prevent future backlogs with sexual assault kits. So it would set procedures for who collects the evidence, who's responsible for storing it, how quickly it is processed, gives victims more involvement in the state so they can more involvement in their cases so that they can track where their evidence is, require it to be processed within 90 days. And so those are all. Excuse me. Those are in both versions of the bill. What differs is the Assembly version has this provision that says if the suspected assailant is an undocumented person, that ICE has to be called. And if a student is assaulted by a classmate or school staff, they would automatically be able to enroll in voucher schools. Immigration and voucher issues, you know, those are things that inspired very strong reactions between the two parties. And so that sent the Democrats off of the Assembly bill very quickly. The key problem here is that, you know, the Assembly and Senate have passed different versions of the bill. there's no sign that they're going to reconcile those differences. And so if they don't do that, and if they don't do it very quickly, then nothing's going to happen. And they won't be able to address backlogs of sexual assault kits in any fashion this legislative session.
Why did Republicans say that new legislation was needed on this?
So it's interesting that, you know, this thing started out in the version that passed the Senate. It was bipartisan. It had support pretty steadily along. But then it got stuck in the Assembly. And so David Steffen, one of the lead sponsors of the bipartisan bill, quickly introduced, sort of abruptly introduced, this new version with these other provisions. He said he did that because he needed to find a way to get this bill through the Republican-controlled Assembly, and that he wanted to move the process along. So, you know, the Assembly was stuck. They couldn't apparently get support behind the bipartisan bill, and so they advanced this alternate version of it.
What have we heard out of Governor Evers? Has he voiced whether he would sign the new bill into law?
So he hasn't. So there's no bill getting to him so far because the two parties or the two houses haven't been able to agree. He has generally, like the Attorney General, supported the original bipartisan bill, but Evers has not told us whether he would sign or veto the Republican bill if it gets to him. So I think if the Senate does end up taking the Assembly version of the bill, it's going to be a real question as to whether the governor will swallow those parts of the bill that he doesn't like and sign it, or if he vetoes it and tells the legislature to go start over again, which would be the next legislative session most likely, which doesn't start till a year from now.
If no legislation is passed, where does that leave the state in terms of preventing another backlog of sexual assault evidence?
So the State Department of Justice says right now that there's not a backlog. This is sort of forward-looking legislation, and this is why some of the Republicans in the Assembly say there's not an urgency here. We don't have a backlog. There was a previous backlog that got cleared under current law, and so we can look at this. We can find a way to address it, but it's not a matter of sort of emergency because there is no existing backlog.
We're talking state politics with Patrick Marley, who covers the Capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in. What do you think about the delays in closing the youth prison, Lincoln Hills? What do you think of the plan for smaller regional facilities? What questions do you have about juvenile detention centers in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Patrick, you've been covering the state's embattled youth prisons since they were raided in 2015 following allegations of inmate abuse. Lawmakers had approved a plan to close Lincoln Hills by July 2021, but those plans have had a bunch of setbacks. What are the latest developments in this?
So it's interesting. Lawmakers decided in 2018 that they were going to close Lincoln Hills, and at that time they were going to close it by the beginning of 2021, passed a bill to do that. Time went on, and they and the administration, but first of Scott Walker and then of Tony Evers, found that the timeline was a little hasty, that to build these new facilities and move the inmates from the current ones to the new ones was going to take more time. And so Evers asked for sort of an open-ended schedule of, well, we'll close it as soon as possible. Republicans were very opposed to that, and many Democrats were very opposed to that, saying you need a hard deadline. We'll give you a six-month extension. So just less than a year ago, they passed a new law that said it would close by the summer of 2021. This last week, the legislature's budget committee essentially abandoned that idea, abandoned that timeline. They funded part of the projects to replace Lincoln Hills, but not all of them. And they've acknowledged now that because of what these funding decisions they've made, the state won't meet that deadline. We don't know when Lincoln Hills will close. Frankly, we don't really know if it will ever close given the parameters they've set, though, you know, lawmakers could address this in the future by funding these new facilities they say they want to build.
So what is the status of these new regional facilities that are meant to ultimately replace Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake?
So it's all over the map. There's four county facilities that the Budget Committee approved. But they shorted Milwaukee County on funding for its project, so there's not there'd be no place to house female offenders from Milwaukee County, and they although they shorted Milwaukee County, in all they wanted to give $20 million more than what they had available. So they need to get permission from another state entity, the State Building Commission, to fully fund those four facilities, and that would be $100 million in all. But there's also supposed to be two state-run facilities that would be more secure for, in many cases, higher-risk offenders, and that is expected to cost about $74 million. They didn't fund any of that, so there's no plan to build those facilities. There also needs to be an expanded mental health facility in Madison at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. That's ready to go, but lawmakers have not funded it yet, so that remains on hold as well. So you've really got about a third of what they need to do has gotten some sort of initial approval, but not the final approval to put shovels in the ground.
So while lawmakers are having this broader debate about juvenile corrections and how it should be structured, do you have a sense at all whether conditions have improved for inmates and staff at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake?
They say that they have. Both the Department of Corrections and the ACLU, which brought the lawsuit against the state over conditions there, say that things have improved. It can be a bumpy road, as the Secretary of Corrections recently put it. They did last fall have some outbursts that were pretty problematic, and they had to involve law enforcement. Charges were issued in at least one case out of that. So it's not like everything is as it should be necessarily there, but they seem to be improved from when they were experiencing the most problems there.
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers state politics from the Capitol in Madison. Just ahead, we explore African American genealogy and tracing your family's roots back before emancipation in 1863 with a genealogy specialist from the Wisconsin Historical Society. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.